Well, it certainly doesn't help him. It fits into the narrative that the prosecution has put forward, but this was not an act that was done in self-defense, but one that was done in anger. So from that perspective, it's certainly evidence that is favorable for the prosecution, which is no doubt why they made it a key element of their presentation to the jury. It's consistent with what they have promised as part of their opening statements and part of their narrative as part of the case. So I think it's very good for the prosecution.
Rod Sullivan, what about the testimony that she gave that it was she who decided that they should leave, that they should go back to the hotel, that they should leave Jacksonville altogether when they realized that someone was shot and killed the night before?
Well, that does take some of the pressure off Michael Dunn, but I think in overall, I think her testimony was more favorable for the prosecution than it was for the defense. I mean, here you have a man going to his son's wedding. His spouse is, and he are divorced. He probably, he's bringing a new girlfriend whose family never met. So there's a lot of emotions there. He has three rum and cokes and gets in a car and drives to the station. And she doesn't really see anything that helps him. She doesn't see a gun. She doesn't see any threats. And then after it's all over, he drives with her to St. Augustine. They stay at a B&B. They drive down to Satellite Beach, and he never mentions a gun. As a matter of fact, he never mentions a gun until after he talks to a friend of his who's a police officer. I don't think any of those facts are very good for Michael Dunn.
So where do we expect this to go today, Sam? What other witnesses do we expect the prosecution to call today?
Well, in any homicide trial, one of the things that the state of Florida has an obligation to prove to the jury is both the manner and cause of death, and that's done in our system through the testimony of a medical examiner or an assistant medical examiner. I would expect that will probably be their final witness or something close to it. That typically can be very compelling testimony because it's very raw. It's very emotional. It brings home the reality of homicide, which is that someone has died and the manner in which that happened and the cause of that death. Once that takes place, and obviously I think there are some evidence technicians, some what we call cleanup witnesses that would need to be done involving the crime scene, you'll probably see the prosecution wrap up shortly after that.
Is there potential that the medical examiner could shed some light on whether Jordan Davis was out of the car or trying to get out of the vehicle?
To a certain extent. I mean, the medical examiner, what he or she is able to do in that situation is look purely at the physical evidence of the decedent. What does the evidence of how this individual lost their life tell us about how that happened? What can the hard evidence provide that either corroborates or contradicts the testimonial evidence, either from the other people in the car or other witnesses, or perhaps ultimately the defendant himself?
Again, you can weigh in on our conversation this morning about the Michael Dunn trial. Give us a call at 549-2937. Rod Sullivan, professor at Florida Coastal School of Law, the question everyone is asking now, will Michael Dunn take the stand in his own defense? And most legal experts seem to say that he has to.
Sure. There's nobody else who's going to be able to tell the story. And this is going to be, in my opinion, the most interesting part of the trial. How good a witness is Michael Dunn in his own defense? How good is he at convincing people that he truly had fear of great bodily harm or imminent death if he didn't draw his weapon and fire it? And then the second most important thing that's going to happen is the cross-examination of this guy. You know, if he is a terrible witness for himself, do you want to give him the opportunity to rehabilitate himself on cross-examination? If he's a good witness for himself on direct, do you want to bore into him to reveal the inconsistencies in his testimony?
And we are taking calls. Jay in Jack's Beach has called in. Good morning, Jay. What are your thoughts on this case?
I've got two questions. One is with the letters and recorded conversations of Michael Dunn, how is that going to impact this case? And my other question is that there seems to be this thing that Jordan Davis is getting out of the car, and that seems to be very new based on the accounts that have been given thus far, but it doesn't seem to be supported by the witness testimony that's been given thus far. So I'm just wondering what your response to those two issues are.
All right, thanks, Jay. Sam Garrison, we haven't really heard from any witnesses who would back up that claim that Jordan Davis was getting out of the car.
Well, you're correct. Ultimately, we don't know what, if anything, the defendant himself would say, because that is really the most important testimony should he decide to offer it on that issue. On the other question, as it relates to a lot of the jail or the statements that were intercepted from Mr. Dunn in the jail, that was certainly very, very noteworthy information from a media standpoint. But for the specific issue that's before the jury as to what happened at that gate station on that night, it really is not material. And so that's one of the things that the lawyers were arguing about as part of the what I call it the side trial, which is the public access via media outlets to some of this information that they would otherwise be entitled to under Florida's public records laws. How relevant is that to the issue before us right now, which is guilty, not guilty?
And it's interesting how long that argument is taking. It by the time those come to light, the trial may be over.
Correct. And one of the things I think that you can sense in some of the frustration, I assume, from both the prosecution and the defense in this case, is that while those issues may be a very may have a great deal of interest to the public at large, for the trial lawyers and for the judge presiding over the charge of first-degree murder and three additional counts of attempted murder, I think it is, they're really not relevant to that particular issue. They're relevant for the societal discussion at large, but as to the question of guilty versus not guilty, they don't have any factual bearing on that, which is why you're not seeing those issues as part of the trial. Now, they may come up depending on if the defendant testifies and if he does what's called opening the door.
Mm-hmm.
In other words, makes a statement during his testimony that it can be contradicted by facts that are outside of those that have been presented in the prosecution's case. But that really is dependent on if the defendant testifies. If so, what does he say? And can those issues then be brought in to impeach the credibility of what he says in his testimony?
And I'm sure his attorney has coached him not to open that door.
I would imagine so.
You can join the conversation. Give us a call at 549-2937 or tweet me at Karen Fagans. And we do have a tweet from Ben. Ben asks, the defense has been aggressive in its questioning. Are they walking a line of alienating the jury? We'll send that question to you, Rod Sullivan.
Well, here's the thing. Corey Stroller is a South Florida attorney, and there is a definite difference in approaches to juries between South Florida and North Florida. And so consequently, he's coming up here, and he's aggressively cross-examining every single witness on every single point. And that's that can tend to alienate a jury, and it may be a trial tactic that would not well serve for Jacksonville. That having been said, though, these cases get decided more on the facts than on the personality of the lawyers. So I don't think it's going to really make a difference to the outcome.
The personalities do tend to play a role, though, with juries, and as you pointed out, Jacksonville is quite different from South Florida.
Yeah, certainly they do, and but these are the things that shouldn't play a role, but they do. I would like to agree with what Sam said earlier, is that racial animus, if Michael Dunn bears racial animus toward African Americans, that's really not probative of the question of whether or not he murdered Jordan Davis and attempted to murder the other three. But it is very inflammatory. So the court, the pretrial letters, the pretrial phone calls and all could really have poisoned the jury pool in Jacksonville if they come out to a greater extent than they already did. And it really, it really shouldn't play a role.
We say that things like personality of the lawyers shouldn't factor in to a trial.
And they shouldn't, though.
But you cannot help it. One of the favorite sayings that I've heard that I've adopted a lot and talk to clients and people all the time is, the law is black and white, but it's implemented by people who are flesh and blood.
Mm-hmm.
And so these jurors are human. They are going to make snap judgments and then also have those judgments affected during the course of the trial by who they like, who they don't like, more importantly, who they trust and who they don't trust. And that's very important for the lawyers. Who do they understand in terms of how they communicate? Do they get the impression that this person is asking the questions that I want to have answered? Do they develop a comfort? Do they develop, I've said trust, but that really is true, a trusting relationship with the lawyers. And that's a very difficult thing for the lawyers to try to to try to accomplish in their dealings with the jury over the course of a number of days. And it really is important. So one of the things that as trial lawyers you look at is you may be able to ask a question of a witness. You may be able to be demonstrative. You might want to get in their face or back off. But you always got to be cognizant of how your actions, both verbal and nonverbal, are going to be assessed by the jury. The last thing you want to do in any sort of a case, whether you're a prosecution or on the defense side, is lose that most critical element, which is the trust of the jury. If you lose that, you got big problems.
One thing that I think is really interesting is these commentaries by the Zimmerman attorney, Mark O'Mara, that have been running in the Florida Times Union. The latest one says that it will be hard to defend the last set of shots that were fired. There were three separate sets of shots, three shots, a pause, three shots, a pause, and then four more shots. And the last shots that were fired at the Durango as the SUV was pulling away. So he points out in this this analysis that not only is Michael Dunn facing this first-degree murder charge, there are three attempted murder charges. And it could be difficult to defend against those attempted murder charges if he's firing at a vehicle that's essentially driving away. Rod Sullivan, what's your reaction to that analysis?
I think he's absolutely right. You know, even if he's acting in self-defense, he fires the first round, first three rounds, into the passenger side rear seat where Jordan Davis is sitting. But then, as the car is pulling away, he fires three to four more rounds at the driver's on the front passenger seat. And then the car is driving toward the next parking lot, and he fires another three rounds at the car as it's leaving the scene. So if you somehow justify those first three shots as saying, I believe a shotgun was coming up at me, and how do you justify the next seven? I don't really think you have. I haven't heard a good answer for that.
One of the things, piggybacking on Professor Sullivan's point there, Karen, as it relates to the Zimmerman trial, which you just brought up with Mark O'Mara as lead counsel for the defense, what you saw when people who do this for a living, when they looked at the Zimmerman case, they would say, you know, putting aside the issues of societal import, race, all the issues, should we have stand your ground, should we not, from a purely legal perspective, most everyone who looked at that case said the prosecution's going to have some serious hurdles to overcome. This is a tough legal case. Contrast that with the Dunn case that we've been watching here. What you don't see in this case is the same level of criticism of the prosecution's case here that you saw there. And it has nothing to do with their performance or lack thereof. It's just the facts in this case are not good for the defense. They're just simply not. When you have 11 shots fired, I think is what it is, 10 or 11.
I think it's 10.
10, yeah. When you have multiple shots fired, when you have pauses between the shots, which allow for the prosecution then to argue just what Professor Sullivan was pointing out, that even if the first volley, so to speak, was done without some thought, what about the second? What about the third? When you have the defendant leaving the scene, as the prosecution will describe, fleeing the scene, and not staying there, as was the case in the Zimmerman prosecution. In other words, this case has garnered a lot of national attention, I believe, as an aftershock of the Zimmerman case, because it involves some of the same people. It involves issues of claimed self-defense. It involves an African American victim and a non-African American suspect, and it involves Florida. So there's a lot of similarities, but from a legal perspective, this is a much, much, much stronger case for the state of Florida, for the prosecution, than was the case in the Zimmerman trial.
So were it not for Zimmerman, the national media might not be interested in this case at all.
I think it would certainly have local interest because it's a big case here locally. But the reason the CNN trucks are parked out in front of the Duval County Courthouse, unfortunately, or fortunately, depending how you look at it, has very little to do with that case and a lot to do with the aftershocks of what happened down in Sanford.
We're still getting calls on this. If you want to join the conversation, we're talking about the second week of the Michael Dunn case. Give us a call at 549-2937. We'll go now to Eric in Jacksonville Beach. Good morning, Eric.
Good morning. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for calling.
I wanted to ask, on the news a lot lately, you've seen, they're talking about the cultural repercussions that this case is having already and will have it as it moves through. And they're making a pretty big story out of the volume and content of the music. My question is, do you think that that will have any effect on the outcome of the trial? And if not, why is it even being discussed in the news? Thank you.
Rod Sullivan, can you handle that question?
Well, yeah, I mean, if you look at the lyrics on the song Beef, they're misogynistic, they're violent. There's even a line in there about, you know, if you come at me with one shot, I'm going to come at with you with 10, and I'm going to shoot you in the head, and you're never going to think again. It's sort of ironic that that's the lyrics that are playing at the time that Jordan Davis and Michael Dunn are having their argument. Does the fact that these are lyrics that would offend most people justify anything that Michael Dunn did? No, of course not. But I guess it's just, you know, the reason that this all came about was because of this verbal exchange over loud music. So maybe we put too much emphasis on the music and not enough emphasis on the fact that we're going to hear Michael Dunn say that Jordan Davis said to him, "You're going to die today, MF." And when he says those words, I think that's going to be Dunn's argument that he felt threatened.
Another thing that I wanted to bring up here is when you look at the charge of first-degree murder, I've heard a couple of analysts say that perhaps that that might be an overcharge. First-degree murder, you have to prove some type of premeditation. And that doesn't mean someone's sitting there thinking about it for days ahead of time. There's no time limit on the premeditation, but that they thought it through before the shots were fired. Do you think it's going to be difficult for the state to prove this first-degree murder for conviction?
Well, let me just say, under 10/20 life, it really doesn't matter. The decision on the length of the sentence has been taken out of the hands of the judge because it's a firearm and a felony. And so consequently, whether he's convicted of first-degree murder or second-degree murder is not going to affect, in my opinion, the length of his sentence.
Does it matter what he's charged with at the beginning of the trial, though? Would it have been easier to get a conviction if it was a second-degree murder trial?
Well, it's a lesser-included offense, and therefore I don't think it's going to matter much. You know, the jury could go back there and say, yeah, he didn't premeditate this. This is a second-degree murder. You know, Michael Dunn is still going away to jail for the rest of his life. There is premeditation here. I mean, Dunn had to actually reach into his car. He did not have a round in the chamber. He had to crank around into the chamber and fire. I mean, that's enough time, in my opinion, to think and reflect about the consequences of your actions, which is all that's necessary to get it up to a first-degree murder.
Yeah,
Sam Garrison?
Without getting too much into the weeds, Professor Sullivan's correct. From a practical standpoint, a conviction for second-degree murder for someone of Mr. Dunn's age is a de facto life sentence. If you're convicted of first-degree murder, which has to be brought by a grand jury as an indictment under Florida law, it's mandatory life without parole, period. If you are convicted of second-degree murder under the 10/20 life statute, what that means is you are required to be sentenced to a minimum of 25 years, day for day, no credit for good time, up to life in prison. Well, for someone of Mr. Dunn's age, that is a de facto life sentence. So Professor Sullivan is correct from that standpoint. Strategically, it is a general practice, both here in the Fourth Circuit and I assume throughout the rest of the state and nation, prosecutors are going to charge as high as they can. With the understanding, if a jury compromises, they would have in the back. You know, if the jurors are in the back room, they're having trouble deciding what it is. They have to compromise.
Yeah.
If they're going to compromise on second degree, which is a de facto life sentence, versus compromise on a manslaughter or a not guilty.
So if they can't quite get there, they can say, "Well, we can't agree on first degree murder, but second degree."
From a strategic perspective, for the prosecution, certainly they want to charge as high of an element, an offense as they think the facts can support. The risk in doing that, however, like I talked about earlier, is you don't want to lose that trust. So if the jury believes, wait a minute, you've gone too far, this is clearly not a first-degree murder, it's something else, it can erode that trust relationship that the prosecutors inherently walk into the courtroom with. And so there's a risk there. But in this particular case, whether the jury, put it this way, if the jury is deliberating over a first-degree murder conviction or a second-degree murder prosecution, the state attorney's office would take that as a win 7 days a week.
Mm-hmm. Let's go to Peter now on the south side. Peter, what's your question?
Yes, my question has to do with the claim that it took the police 4 days to go back and look for the suspected shotgun, and I'm wondering how that would affect the credibility of the case and what the police have to say about that.
Yes, this factors heavily into the defense argument. Rod Sullivan, what do you think about that?
Yeah, I mean, this is going to be Corey Stroller's case. First of all, he's going to say that Michael Dunn didn't see anybody else in the car besides Jordan Davis, because only Jordan Davis had his window down, and all the other windows were darkly tinted. Then the car drives 100 yards or so off, and two people get out of the car. Now, there was a person at the Loop restaurant coming out that was concerned enough that he called police, and he said, well, they look like they're stashing something. He looks like they're stashing something in the car. And then the car comes back, and the police do not do a thorough inspection of that entire parking lot, the roofs, and the trash compactors or whatever for a full 4 days. And there's also testimony that two or three of the other survivors made cell phone calls. So what you're going to hear Stroller say is, driver's on probation. If there's a gun in the car, he's going to jail. So they drive away, they get rid of the gun, they call a friend to come pick it up, and that's why they didn't find a gun. Is that going to be enough to create reasonable doubt?
That's the question.
I don't know.
Yeah, I agree with Professor Sullivan. That's really the issue. Without the jury making a finding that Michael Dunn reasonably believed that he was under threat of imminent death or great bodily harm as a result of someone raising a gun, he will be found guilty. Okay, it all hangs on that issue of, do they believe what Michael Dunn has said and we believe will say again? The prosecution will come back and say, hey, that's nice. Where's the shotgun?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, it didn't vanish into thin air. And then the burden kind of goes back to Dunn's attorney, Mr. Stroll, to say, well, hey, you know, it's not our fault that the gun's not here. Blame the law enforcement officers. And so that's kind of the back and forth. That really is the critical element of the case. I think Professor Sullivan has accurately defined it.
All right, let's take one more call from Mike on the West Side. Good morning, Mike. All right, Mike. Looks like we maybe lost your call, so we will go ahead and wrap up this segment. Sam Garrison, can you give us your final thoughts on what we should pay attention to going forward?
I think the critical issue now with the prosecution, where they are in their case, I think the state of Florida is very pleased, at least from what we can see from a distance, with how their presentation has gone forward, how their case has been presented. The burden now goes to the defense as to whether or not they're going to put on a defense or not. They're not required to. The difference, I would tell you, in this situation versus what we saw in the Zimmerman case is, in the Zimmerman case, he spoke to anyone and everyone about what had happened. So the jury was not left with any lingering decisions, even though they're instructed not to have them, about what the other side of the story was. Not so much in this case. I think the jury is going to want to hear from Mr. Dunn. Whether he decides to testify or not is a decision between he and his lawyer. But if he does testify, that certainly will be the next, really the critical stage in this case.
And Rod Sullivan, your last thoughts?
Yeah, I mean, if I was going to sit in on any portion of this trial, it would be the testimony of Dunn and the cross-examination after he testifies. And I think that'll be the most critical stage in determining what the outcome of the case.
Yes, in a case that has received lots of attention, that will be the thing everyone is watching for. All right, thank you both. Sam Garrison, board-certified criminal trial lawyer, now with the firm Kapalousis, Bradley & Garrison, and Rod Sullivan, professor with Florida Coastal School of Law. Thank you so much for your analysis.
Thank you, Karen.
Thank you, Karen.